readers, welcome back to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and this week we'll be traveling around America's literary landscape in a show I'm calling American Voices. For the first time on the show, I'm excited to have as one of my guests a poet of great renown. We're also going to, shall we say, go on the road, and you'll see what I mean in just a moment. So fasten your seatbelts and we'll begin our journey through American Voices.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
I bet most of you have been to Orlando, spending days at different theme parks. Since Miami is my home, when my two kids were small, we journeyed up the turnpike at least once a year to drop our dollars at the attractions. In all those years, I am now embarrassed to admit, we never truly explored the city or realized that, yes, there is culture and history in Orlando. Well, now my kids are in their 20s, and for the moment, I'm done with Disney. But on a recent visit to Orlando, I was extremely fortunate to be introduced to the Jack Kerouac House and an amazing cultural program established there. My guest today is Bob Keeling, a veteran broadcast journalist who makes Orlando his home. Bob has earned 3 Emmys for his work covering national and international stories. You may have seen him on Dateline NBC, the CBS Early Show, MSNBC, CNN, and more. In 1996, Bob discovered the importance of the Kerouac House while he was writing an article about the house for the Orlando Sentinel. The following year, he was contacted by a group of Orlando residents who wanted to save and restore the house. And in 1999, the Jack Kerouac Writer-in-Residence Project was started, dedicated to nurturing the careers of writers as a living tribute to Jack Kerouac. The project has welcomed writers from all over the world. Each applies for a rent-free 3-month residency. The project has been featured in the New York Times, the LA Times, USA Today, and more. And in 2004, Bob published his first book, Kerouac in Florida, Where the Road Ends. Welcome, Bob. It's great to have you with us today.
Thanks a lot, Elaine. I appreciate it.
Now, for our listeners around the country, where in Orlando is the Kerouac House?
The Kerouac House is in a little neighborhood on the northwestern edge of the city of Orlando. It's a little neighborhood called College Park. So it's only about 5 minutes northwest of downtown, not too far away.
All right. Now, Kerouac wasn't born in Orlando, so how did he come to be there?
Well, Kerouac, he had promised his father that he would always take care of his mother. It was like a dying promise to his father. And his mother would always follow her daughter's family around, her daughter Carolyn, and she and her husband Paul had a grandchild, had a son. His name was Paul Jr., and Kerouac would be out on the road doing all of his travels, and so when he needed a place to crash, invariably he would find where his mom was staying and come and crash with her. And so in 1956, Kerouac's mom, Gabrielle, followed her daughter's family down to Orlando because her daughter's husband had just gotten a job at Martin and was interested in trying to make a career for himself in the burgeoning space industry.
And how did you first hear about the house?
Well, I had been down in Key West and just marveled at the Hemingway House. and I was new to Orlando, and I'd come back from Key West thinking, I just wish this area wasn't so devoid of culture. At least that's what I thought at the time, mistakenly. And I had a friend of mine from the Midwest actually tell me that he had been reading On the Road, and he saw on the jacket of the book that it looked as if Kerouac had either lived in Orlando or died in Orlando, and it was just enough of a germ of an idea to try to follow it and see where it would lead me.
Well, I know that Kerouac wrote Dharma Bums at the house, and that was his work directly after On the Road. Visiting the house, it is a modest one, so should we assume that he was not enjoying fame and fortune from On the Road?
No, no, not at all. In fact, I think that's what's one of the most compelling stories surrounding the house is Kerouac's dedication to his craft, to his trade, given the fact that before On the Road was published, during all of the beginning of 57, as he's living in Orlando and other places, and he's making the final edits to On the Road, and he's taking all of these journeys, and he's kind of considered a joke among his extended family. He's 35 years old, he's twice divorced, and kind of thought of immature and rather frivolous. And so it is not until he actually moves into that house in the summer of 57 that he is transformed from this sort of this nomadic nobody from Lowell, Massachusetts, to becoming the Bard of the Beat Generation.
Did any of his Beat Generation friends visit him in Orlando? And if so, what did the neighbors have to say about that?
You know, it's so interesting because when he lived in the Kerouac house in Orlando, which was 57 and 58, none of his friends came to visit. And it was a very isolated place at the time. Obviously, you didn't have the internet. You didn't have cable TV. It was a very pretty spot, but there just wasn't much to do for a guy who was used to the New York lifestyle. So no, they didn't come to visit, and when all was said and done, after he had had his initial burst of fame for On the Road and realized that he had become something of a media darling, before people even knew what that was, he had to come back to Orlando to sort of escape that intense spotlight that he was not ready for. But it was an isolated place, and no, the Beat friends really didn't come to visit that time around.
Now, did Dharma Bums, when it was published, was it initially extremely well received, or what about that?
It didn't receive that kind of adulation that On the Road did. I mean, the big review that made it for him was the New York Times review on Labor Day of 57, that basically it wasn't just a review, it was a coronation. He was the king of the beats, just like Hemingway was the, you know, avatar of the lost generation. So no, Dharma Bums didn't get that type of review, but as time has gone on, it's a very well-regarded book. In fact, it's one of my personal favorites.
I've read a lot of Kerouac myself, and so has my college-age daughter, and we both agree that we like Dharma Bums the best.
Yeah, I think so, too, and I know, just knowing Kerouac's life story and the struggles he'd had with addiction, it was nice to read that he was in a place there in 55 and 56 where he's following this young muse, the poet Gary Snyder, and he's finding a comfortable transition into middle age, which is nice, at least at this one point. You know, he's talking about not needing alcohol and that type of thing, and unfortunately, that phase of his life didn't last long.
Now, when I've been to the Orlando Museum and I've seen the long scroll that On the Road was written on. Was Dharma Bums written on one of these extremely, you know, long scrolls as well?
Yes. He wrote Dharma Bums on a scroll. He later wrote Big Sur here in Orlando on a scroll. And the publishers would be like, okay, that's fine. Yeah, if you have to do it that way, that's fine. Because he said he liked to write fast because life on the road was fast. And he would tape all, he would get a big roll of teletype paper and just go. But then the publishers would say, okay, now we need you to come back and type it in a regular conventional manuscript form. So he would go back and do that after he would do his scroll.
Oh, can our audience visit the house when they're in Orlando? Is it open regularly, or must you make an appointment to visit?
We don't do tours because it is a working writer's residence, and we get a lot of pilgrims that come by and knock on the door. And I mean, it's certainly understandable, but what we're trying trying to do is respect the writer and give them their space to create, and that's really what the Kerouac Project is all about, is the gift of time for writers who otherwise have to worry about paying bills and, you know, working jobs. So what we do is, from time to time, we will have public readings at the house where you can come in and not only see where Kerouac plied his trade, but you can also enjoy some of the fruits of the current writer's labors. And the best way to find out about that is either visit our website at KerouacProject.org or friend us on Facebook.
How did the Artists in Residence program get started? Talk a little bit about that.
Back when I had first published my original research into the historic importance of the house in 1997 to mark Kerouac's 75th birthday, I was contacted by a number of local residents who thought it would be a great idea to save the house and restore it. And I signed on just because I thought it was a great idea too. And thanks to the hard work of many grassroots people who cared about the idea of saving this little place, we all came up with the Kerouac Project, and we thought it would be a wonderful way to be a living literary tribute to Kerouac. And I dare say, after more than a decade of writers coming here from all over the world, on that sense, mission accomplished.
Would popular culture people recognize some of the names of people that have been in the program?
You know, I think it's mostly up-and-coming writers. However, we do have a number who've gone on to publish their own works. I think of Liza Monroy, who just had her book Mexican High published a couple of years ago. She's a very promising young writer. We also have a board of advisors that includes Kerouac's musical collaborator David Amram, who is just a wonderful world musician who's now 80 years young and going stronger than ever. So we have this really nice mix of up-and-coming artists and established folks working together to make sure the Kerouac Project stays vital.
When you say up-and-coming, is there an age limit to people who can apply, or can a new writer at age 55 apply?
Oh, absolutely. There are no age limits. There are no nationality limits. There's no limits on sexual orientation, any of that. It's about people who are passionate about writing. We had a guy named Bill Miles, who was a former Alaskan state legislator, along with Sarah Palin and many others, who is just this fantastic writer, who I would say might be a few seconds over 50, and came in and was just a wonderful writer in residence. So no, there's no age limit whatsoever.
And where can aspiring writers find out about the program?
You can go to KerouacProject.org and look in the applications button. And we do now have, in fact, we're accepting applications right now, and it's an online application process. And I should mention that it costs $20 to apply, but it is to support our nonprofit charity up here, because it's the tax deductible contributions that keep us living and breathing.
Tell us a little about your current project, your most recent book that's come out. It's a little unusual. Then tell us about it.
It's a little off the beaten track, okay? When you think about Jack Kerouac, my first book was called Kerouac in Florida, and the title's pretty obvious. But there was another story I became enamored with here that's Orlando and Central Florida-centric, and it's the story of the woman who founded the Tupperware Company, or I should say she came up with the home party idea, Brownie Wise, and she was this trailblazing Florida businesswoman who should be right up there with Oprah and Martha Stewart. She was a real trailblazer. She spent a good amount of time there in South Florida as well. And she helped make Earl Tupper a very rich man. And I did an investigative chronicle of their rise to the spectacular heights that they took Tupperware in the 1950s. And the book is called Tupperware Unsealed.
All right.
And Brownie is this amazing woman who was far ahead of her time. She was a single mother, running a company in the deep south in the early 1950s. Can you imagine such a thing?
No.
And she was able to use her amazing ability not only to communicate with her dealers, but also motivate them to lead Tupperware to some spectacular sales figures and expansion. She was the first woman ever on the cover of Business Week. And if you want to hear a really great hidden history story from Florida, this is the one.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Bob. You have uncovered a lot of hidden nuggets in Central Florida.
Absolutely. And the next book is going to be a rock and roll story that covers the whole state about the iconic country rock avatar Graham Parsons, who is from Winter Haven.
All right. We'll look forward to that. Thank you.
Thanks, Elaine.
All right.
In The Dharma Bombs, written in Orlando by Jack Kerouac, two young men are engaged in a passionate search for Dharma or truth. Their major adventure is the pursuit of the Zen Way, which takes them climbing into the High Sierras to seek the lesson of solitude, a lesson that has a hard time surviving their forays into the pagan groves of San Francisco's Bohemia with its marathon wine-drinking bouts, poetry jam sessions, and other non-ascetic pastimes. This autobiographical novel appeared just a year after the author's explosive On the Road put the Beat Generation on the literary map and Kerouac on the bestseller list. The same expansiveness, humor, and contagious zest for life that sparked the earlier novels ignites this one. Tom Parker narrates.
I had not met Jaffe Ryder yet. I was about to the next week, or heard anything about Dharma bums. Although at this time I was a perfect Dharma bum myself and considered myself a religious wanderer. The little bum in the gondola solidified all my beliefs by warming up to the wine and talking, and finally whipping out a tiny slip of paper which contained a prayer by St. Teresa, announcing that after her death she will return to the earth by showering it with roses from heaven forever for all living creatures. "Where did you get this?" I asked. "Oh, I cut it out of a reading room magazine in Los Angeles a couple of years ago. I always carry it with me." "And you squat in boxcars and read it?" "Most every day." He talked not much more than this, didn't amplify on the subject of St. Teresa, and was very modest about his religion and told me little about his personal life. He is the kind of thin, quiet little bum nobody pays much attention to, even in Skid Row, let alone Main Street. If a cop hustled him off, he hustled and disappeared. And if yard dicks were around in big city yards when a freight was pulling out, chances are they never got a sight of the little man hiding in the weeds and hopping on in the shadows. When I told him I was planning to hop the Zipper first-class freight train the next night, he said, "Ah, you mean the Midnight Ghost. Is that what you call the Zipper? You must have been a railroad man on that railroad." "I was. I was a brakeman on the SP. "Well, we bums call it the Midnight Ghost, 'cause you get on it at L.A. and nobody sees you till you get to San Francisco in the morning. The thing flies so fast. 80 miles an hour on the straightaways, Pap." "That's right, but it gets mighty cold at night when you're flying up that coast north of Gaviota and up around Surf." "Surf, that's right. Then the mountains down south of Margarita." "Margarita, that's right. But I've rid that Midnight Ghost more times than I can count, I guess." "How many years since you've been home?" "More years than I care to count, I guess. Ohio was where I was from." But the train got started, the wind grew cold and foggy again, and we spent the following hour and a half doing everything in our power and willpower not to freeze and chatter teeth too much. I'd huddle and meditate on the warmth, the actual warmth of God, to obviate the cold. Then I'd jump up and flap my arms and legs and sing. But the little bum had more patience than I had, and just lay there most of the time, chewing his cud in forlorn, bitter-lipped thought. My teeth were chattering, my lips blue. By dark we saw with relief the familiar mountains of Santa Barbara taking shape, and soon we'd be stopped and warm in the warm, starlit night by the tracks. I bade farewell to the little bum of St. Teresa at the crossing, where we jumped off, and went to sleep the night in the sand in my blankets, far down the beach at the foot of a cliff where cops wouldn't see me and drive me away. I cooked hot dogs on freshly cut and sharpened sticks over the coals of a big wood fire, and heated a can of beans and a can of cheese macaroni in the red-hot hollows, and drank my newly bought wine, and exulted in one of the most pleasant nights of my life. I waded in the water and dunked a little, and stood looking up at the splendorous night sky, Avalokitesvara's ten-wondered universe of darkened diamonds. "Well, Ray," says I, glad, "only a few miles to go. You've done it again." Happy, just in my swim shorts, barefooted, wild-haired, in the red fire dark, singing, swigging wine, spitting, jumping, running. That's the way to live. All alone and free in the soft sands of the beach by the sigh of the sea out there, with the Mawink Fallopian Virgin warm stars reflecting on the outer channel fluid belly waters. And if your cans are red hot and you can't hold them in your hands, just use good old railroad gloves, that's all. I let the food cool a little to enjoy more wine and my thoughts. I sat cross-legged in the sand and contemplated my life. Well, there, and what difference did it make? What's going to happen to me up ahead? Then the wine got to work on my taste buds, and before long I had to pitch into those hot dogs, biting them right off the end of the stick spit, and chomp, chomp, and dig down into the two tasty cans with the old pack spoon, spooning up rich bites of hot beans and pork, or of macaroni with sizzling hot sauce, and maybe a little sand thrown in. And how many grains of sand are there on this beach, I think? Why, as many grains of sand as there are stars in that sky. Chomp, chomp. And if so, how many human beings have there been? In fact, how many living creatures have there been since before the less part of beginningless time?
I've struck it. Mark Twain wrote in a 1904 letter to a friend, and I will give it away to you. You will never know how much enjoyment you have lost until you get to dictating your autobiography. Thus, after dozens of false starts and hundreds of pages, we have The Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, the complete and authoritative edition. In it, Twain embarked on his final and right plan for telling the story of his life. He left strict instructions that many of these texts must remain unpublished for 100 years, so that when they came out, he would be, quote, dead, unaware, and indifferent, leaving him very free to speak his whole frank mind. 2010 marked the 100th anniversary of Twain's death. In celebration of this important milestone, here, for the first time, is Mark Twain's uncensored autobiography in its entirety, exactly as he left it. This major literary event offers the first of three volumes and presents Mark Twain's authentic and unsuppressed voice, brimming with humor, ideas, opinions, and speaking clearly from the grave as he intended. One reader felt, quote, "I truly believe I was having tea with Samuel Clemens and listening to his wonderful stories. I could almost smell the cigar smoke." The work has been edited by Eleanor Smith and other editors of the Mark Twain Project, and it's read by Grove Gardner.
Clemens wrote this manuscript, now in the Mark Twain papers, sometime in 1870, leaving it incomplete and without a title, but with space for one on the first page. It is the earliest extant manuscript that might fairly be called a draft chapter for his autobiography. Although he did not explicitly identify it as such, he evidently planned to publish it in some way, for he changed the reference to his father's nemesis from Ira Stout to Ira Blank. The text has never been accurately published before. Albert Bigelow Paine did include it in Mark Twain's autobiography under the title he gave it, The Tennessee Land, but he silently omitted the anecdote at the end of the third paragraph, beginning with a venerable lady, and changed Clemens's description of his father as a candidate for county judge with a certainty of election, to say instead that he had been elected to the clerkship of the surrogate court. Mark Twain's Autobiography, Part 1, pages 3-6. Neither description is accurate. See the appendix, Family Biographies, page 654. Available for download at www.marktwainproject.org and at www.blackstoneaudio.com on the product description page. Charles Nider reprinted the text from the manuscript, restoring the anecdote omitted by Paine, but adopting Paine's changed description of John Marshall Clemens. He also made dozens of his own omissions and changes, and he appended two paragraphs from My Autobiography, Random Extracts from It, written in Vienna in 1897 to 98. Autobiography of Mark Twain, pages 22 to 24. Clemens returned to the subject of the Tennessee land in that manuscript and in the autobiographical dictation of the 5th of April, 1906. John Marshall Clemens's land purchases and the family's subsequent sales of the land have been only partly documented from independent sources. The extant grants, deeds, and bills of sale are incomplete, but it was also the case that contradictory or inaccurate deeds often led to disputed claims. Orion Clemens referred to one cause of such conflict in a letter to his brother on the 7th of July, 1869, alleging that Tennessee grants the same land over and over again to different parties.
Campbell McGrath hails from Chicago, where he received his BA from the University of Chicago. He then went on to get his MFA from Columbia University. Influenced by, among others, Walt Whitman, Carl Sandburg, and Sylvia Plath, McGrath writes predominantly free verse, long-lined documentary poems, deeply engaged with American popular culture and commerce, work that has been described as ironic romanticism. A master of the long poem, he has also written many prose poems as well as shorter lyrics. McGrath has published 9 books of poetry, including Spring Comes to Chicago, which won the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. The centerpiece of the collection and one of McGrath's most popular poems is the Bob Hope poem, a 70-page opus, which McGrath described as not a narrative, but a symphonic structure. McGrath has won numerous awards, including a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant and a Guggenheim Fellowship. He has taught at the University of Chicago, Northwestern University, and is currently at Florida International University. Welcome, Campbell. It's so nice to have you with us today.
Thanks, Elaine. It's great to be here.
Now, the Book Report is a fairly new show, and this is the first time we'll be speaking about books of poetry, so I'm very excited that you're here. I know that I'm very interested, and I believe our listeners are interested, in how and when you began writing.
Well, I think, like almost all writers, I began not as a writer but as a reader, and that's something that I was just always doing and was kind of, you know, famous for, as it were. Just loved reading. So it's no surprise to me that books became what I do for a living, but I wouldn't have known that writing books was what I was going to do for a living. So, well, not that I do it for a living, by the way, since I'm a university professor for a living. I write poetry just to entertain myself, basically. But I was writing like kids write. If they give you a choice in sixth grade to write a book report or write a story, I would always choose the story. You know, okay, if there's a creative project, I'll try that. But it wasn't serious. I didn't think I was a writer. But by the end of high school, I was already writing poetry, and then I knew I really liked it. And then, lo and behold, I just kept choosing the creative option like I did in sixth grade. And then if you keep choosing that option and you don't ever hit a wall you can't jump over, you end up here.
Right. How did you discover your unique voice? Because your work is very unique. So how did you discover that?
Well, I think that, discovering your voice is a big question. I mean, I teach creative writing. I'm constantly talking about that with my students. You know, you have to discover your voice. You have to develop your own voice. Of course, as soon as you discover your voice, what you want to do is then learn how to discover another voice and another voice, because we really don't just have one voice as writers. We have multiple voices. So for me, it was kind of plugging into popular culture and America, because I'd been taught to write poetry in college, university, in a kind of very old-fashioned way, and you had to write poems about very important subjects, you know, famous paintings in Italy or something, you know, things that were deemed appropriate for poetry. And I could do that, and I realized, though, I don't really care that much. I mean, there's nothing I had to say about a famous painting from the Italian Renaissance that 500 years of famous poets haven't already said. But the 7-Eleven, on the other hand, was something that I did have a lot to say about, and nobody had written poems about 7-Elevens, so I said, that's what I'm going to do, and it was really then, and that was when I was in graduate school, my maybe I was 24 or so. I said, that's what I really need to be writing about, need to be talking about. And then I think my voice came in large part from identifying the real subject that I should be writing about.
I think that a lot of our readers and our listeners feel that they have a book inside them. Can you share your experience of first being published?
Yeah, first of all, I think that's true, that many, many people have books inside of them. Many, many people have voices, the writer's voices. They may not yet be writers, but it's kind of like, you know, it takes a while to tune your mental radio to hear your writer's voice that's inside of you. My own first publication, I mean, you know, was just getting a couple of poems published. You know, that, I mean, getting a first book published was very exciting, but for me, I think more exciting was getting my very first poems published, which was in a literary magazine, the Ohio Review, and it was in maybe 1986 or 7. And I just remember, you know, it was, couldn't have been more exciting. And, you know, I got a check for $50, I'm pretty sure. And my wife and I went out and had a dinner in New York City. I was living in New York, and it just couldn't have been more exciting. I remember being told, actually, by someone who was a teacher of mine, that all checks like that you get, the $50, $100 that you get for writing poetry, that the appropriate god to dedicate them to was Bacchus. So really, they were for eating and drinking. That wasn't money you're supposed to save for some sensible purpose.
What advice do you have for poets in our audience?
Well, I don't think that poets are that different from other kinds of writers. You know, all writers should, you know, should heed certain basic rules. You should be reading, and you should be writing, and you should be, you know, stealing as much time from, you know, what you have to do to make your real life work to cultivate your writing. I do think it's important to stress the reading role in that. I mean, I do think it's true. Every writer has, you know, begins as a reader, and really good writers continue as great readers. You know, as much as you learn through practicing your craft, you learn from reading others and saying, oh, look how that person did that. Oh, that's fascinating. Can I try that? Then you do try it, but you have to keep reading to expand your vision of what the art can do. I think poets are really the same as fiction writers in that. Just get your hands on poems you love. Try to imitate them. See where, you know, moving the pen down the paper is where, you know, the poem suddenly appears.
Have you ever have been overcome with a desire to cross over and write short stories or even fiction, long stories, long novels?
Not really. As a reader, I read novels. I mean, as a kid and as a young person, novels are what I loved. I didn't love poetry. I loved novels. I would love to be a great novelist. That sounds great. But as a writer, what I really like is poetry. I mean, maybe that sounds weird, but if you give me the two choices, one is really hard for me and one is easy. One seems like a real burden and difficult, and I just get frustrated by it. There's a lot of things you have to do in fiction that I'm just not interested in doing. I just want to already, you talk about voice, I want my voice to just be the poem. And in poetry, right, the very first word I write is my voice. I'm talking. I'm already directing the poem forward. In fiction, you have to establish the characters and paint three walls of the room and create this. You know, I'm like, I'm already bored of that room. I just want to start. So poetry allows me a kind of immediacy. You know, I've written, I'll get asked to write an essay on a poet. And I'll say, okay, I'll write this essay. And after like, you know, a week or two, I turn the essay into a poem and I send it to the editor and say, I'm sorry, it's a poem. And if you don't want it, that's, I understand.
So who are you reading right now for pleasure?
Well, again, for pleasure, I read a lot of, you know, fiction and a lot of nonfiction. I certainly read poetry too, but I'm writing a book that won't be done for 3 or 4 or 5 years. That's about the 20th century. A lot of figures in the 20th century, almost, you know, kind of biographically. So I've been reading tons of biographies. I've been reading all about Pablo Picasso was one figure I was really interested in. I've been writing about John Lennon. I'm actually reading the big John Lennon biography right now that came out a year or two ago. It's very good. Mao. Chinese history, Chinese culture. So I've been reading a lot of, you know, nonfiction of a sort to get my head around people's lives in the 20th century.
Well, you teach at Florida International University, and I'm wondering, do you feel that poetry resonates with today's college kids or with open mic nights, and is there a renaissance in American poetry?
Well, poetry really does resonate, yeah. Whether that's a renaissance is a kind of another question. But yes, I mean, within a university community, for instance, the liberal arts are, you know, have been for 30 or 40 years shrinking. Literature, the humanities, these are shrinking it used to be English was the largest subject studied, the largest major of many colleges. Now it's almost everywhere. It's business,
yes.
pre-business administration, whatever you call a college business degree. You know, it's business. It's all about getting training to go get a job in the marketplace, which of course I understand. But the growth area within humanities is creative writing. So in other words, there's no more kids maybe less interested in taking a Shakespeare class than they were 30 years ago, but there are more kids who actually want to try their own writing, whether that's fiction or poetry. And that's why we've seen an absolutely explosive growth in creative writing programs at universities around this country. There were 20 or 30 when I went to graduate school 30 years ago. There are 200 and something now. So kids really do want to write poems.
Well, so you're optimistic about the future of this art form.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, let's put it this way. This art form existed before there were any other art forms. I mean, you know, I think before people were painting those bison on cavern walls in the, 50,000 years ago, people were chanting poems. They were maybe in the form of prayers or incantations, you know, to make the corn grow and keep the tribe alive. You said magic words, and poetry actually stems from that impulse. So I don't think poetry's going anywhere because I think it's that old and that important. Is it going to suddenly take on a bigger, visible role in American culture? No, I do not think so. But that's, you know, that's a part of the accident of how American... I mean, our culture is not particularly literary. It's not even... Our culture is really, frankly, barely interested in having, you know, chalk in the classroom for kids to learn how to read and write. So why would it be interested in something as completely, you know, obscure as poetry?
Well, Florida International is a recipient of a grant from the Knight Foundation. How will that affect your creative writing program?
Oh, that's going to be great. I mean, you know, for the Knight Foundation is, first of all, great. I mean, as listeners of public radio know, as people who, you'll see the Knight Foundation logo all the time attached to things that are about culture, about learning, about just informed citizenry. So it's a great organization. Here in Miami, it's particularly useful. Basically, all of the funding for the arts in Miami comes from the Knight Foundation. So I think in this city, people talk about let's get the economy back on track, let's revitalize. It's been arts and culture that have been the driving force in Miami's improvement in the last decade, and I think that's really important. Specifically at FIU, in my writing program, the Knight Foundation is going to fund some grad students to, you know, on their track to learn to be writers. We're going to get to bring some great kids down here, give them some enhanced funding. They're going to not only, you know, do their own work as writers, they're going to be engaged in the community. They're going to be teaching in public schools. They're going to be working with arts organizations. So I view it as great for those young writers and also as a way for FIU and for writers to get engaged in the community at all levels.
What current projects are you working on, and what's ahead other than this biography that you were talking about?
Yeah, that book is called, you know, For the 20th Century or something, kind of huge history of the 20th century. The last book I actually published inspired it. That's a book called Shannon, a poem of the Lewis and Clark Expedition. And that book also is basically a biography. It's a long historical narrative of 16 days in the life of George Shannon, an 18-year-old kid who was on the Lewis and Clark expedition and who got lost and wandered around alone for 16 days.
How did you find out about him?
Yeah, I'm very interested in history and nonfiction. I read this stuff. And if you read the Lewis and Clark, which is unbelievably fascinating tale, great adventure, very interesting people, there's this little footnote like, oh, by the way, this guy Shannon, who was otherwise not that important on the expedition, got lost. I just remember being fascinated. Wow, what would it be like for an 18-year-old kid to be the totally alone wandering Nebraska in the time when, you know, Nebraska was called, like, was like an American Serengeti, wide open plains of buffalo herds and wolves and, you know, a few scattered tribes of Native Americans. And I just loved the idea of it. And I just thought to myself, I'm going to create that story. And really, a good question would be, why not write that as a novel, Campbell, you know, or why not make a movie about this? Because these are forms for telling stories that people actually care about and pay to go see. But what I do is write poetry. So I wrote this long story in the form of a poem, you know, that's going to make it something that a far fewer people ever pay attention to. But that's just what I do. So that anyway, the paperback of Shannon is going to come out April. And I'll have another book out in 2012, a book of regular, as it were, poems, not a long historical project. That book's going to be called Nouns and Verbs.
I like that title.
Thanks.
Well, actually, we're going to be listening to one of your poems next, and thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thanks, Lane. My pleasure.
Bye.
Books. Books live in the mind like honey inside a beehive, that ambrosial archive, each volume sealed in craft-made paper, nutritive cells, stamen fragrant, snug as apothecary jars. Like fossilized trilobites, or skulls in a torchlit catacomb beneath an ancient city, Byzantium or Ecbatana, or Paris at the end of April, when vendors set their folding tables filled with lily of the valley beside every metro entrance, and the women, coming home from work or market, scented already with the fugitive perfume of Muguet, carry handheld bouquets like pale tapers through the radiant, rain-washed streets at sunset. And then it is night, half the world ruled by dreams, from which arise narrative forms, riddles, fables, myths. As mist lifts from mountain valleys in autumn, as steam belches from fumaroles in benthic trenches, to whose sulfuric cones strange life forms cling, chrome-green crabs and eyeless shrimp, soft-legged starfish, sung to sleep by that curious cousin of the hippopotamus, the whale, who, having first evolved from ocean to land in the ever-eventful Cretaceous, thought better of it, returning, after millions of years, to scholarly contemplation in the mesomorphic, metaphysical library of the sea.
A deeply evocative story of ambition and betrayal, The Paris Wife by Paula McLean captures a remarkable period of time and a love affair between two unforgettable people, Ernest Hemingway and his wife Hadley. Hadley Richardson is a quiet 28-year-old living in Chicago until she meets Ernest Hemingway and her life changes forever. Following a whirlwind courtship and wedding, the pair set sail for Paris, where they become the golden couple in a lively and volatile group, the fabled Lost Generation, that included Gertrude Stein, Ezra Pound, F. Scott, and Zelda Fitzgerald. Though deeply in love, the Hemingways are ill-prepared for their hard-drinking and fast-living life of the Jazz Age in Paris, which hardly values traditional notions of family and monogamy. Surrounded by beautiful women and competing egos, Ernest struggles to find the voice that will earn him a place in history, pouring all the richness and intensity of his life with Hadley and their circle of friends into the novel that will become The Sun Also Rises. Hadley, meanwhile, strives to hold on to her sense of self as the demands of life with Ernest grow costly and her role as wife, friend, and muse becomes more challenging. Despite their extraordinary bond, they eventually find themselves facing the ultimate crisis of their marriage, a deception that will lead to the unraveling of everything they've fought so hard for. This is a portrayal of love and torn loyalty. The Paris Wife is all the more poignant because we know that, in the end, Hemingway wrote that he would rather have died than fallen in love with anyone but Hadley. The book is read by Carrington McDuffie.
Each morning, he'd wake early and dress, and then go upstairs to his room and begin the day's writing. If things weren't hitting for him there, he'd take the notebooks and several well-sharpened pencils and walk to the Closerie des Lilas for a café crème at the marble table he liked best, while Bumby and I breakfasted alone and then dressed for a walk or went out to see friends. In the late afternoon, I'd head home, and if the day had gone well, Ernest would be there at the dining table, looking satisfied, with some nice cold sauterne or brandy and seltzer, and ready to talk about anything. Or we would go out together, leaving Bumby with our landlady, Madame Chotard, and find a plate of fat oysters and good talk at the Select or the Dumb or the Dumagot. Interesting people were everywhere just then. The cafes of Montparnasse breathed them in and out, French painters and Russian dancers and American writers. On any given night, you could see Picasso walking from Saint-Germain to his apartment in the Rue des Grands Augustins, always exactly the same route, and always looking quietly at everyone and everything. Nearly anyone might feel like a painter walking the streets of Paris then, because the light brought it out in you, and the shadows alongside the buildings, and the bridges which seemed to want to break your heart, and the sculpturally beautiful women in Chanel's black sheath dresses, smoking and throwing back their heads to laugh. We could walk into any café and feel the wonderful chaos of it, ordering Pernod or Rum St. James, until we were beautifully blurred and happy to be there together. "Listen," Don Stewart said one night when we were all very jolly and drunk as fishes at the Select. "What you and him have is perfect. No, no." He was slurring now, and his face contorted with feeling. "It's holy, that's what I meant to say." "That's swell of you, Don. You're all right, too, you know." I cupped his shoulder lightly, afraid he might cry. He was a humorist, and everyone knew the funny writers were the most serious sort under their skins. He also wasn't married yet, but there were prospects on the horizon, and it was all very important to him to see that marriage could be done gracefully and well. Not everyone believed in marriage then. To marry was to say you believed in the future and in the past, too, that history and tradition and hope could stay knit together to hold you up. But the war had come and stolen all the fine young men, and our faith, too. There was only today to throw yourself into without thinking about tomorrow, let alone forever. To keep you from thinking, there was liquor, an ocean's worth at least, all the usual vices, and plenty of rope to hang yourself with. But some of us, a very few in the end, bet on marriage against the odds. And though I didn't feel holy exactly, I did feel that what we had was rare and true, and that we were safe in the marriage we had built and were building every day. This isn't a detective story, not hardly. I don't want to say, keep watch for the girl who will come along and ruin everything. But she's coming anyway, set on her course, in a gorgeous chipmunk coat and fine shoes, her sleek brown hair bobbed so close to her well-made head, she'll seem like a pretty otter in my kitchen. Her easy smile, her fast, smart talk, while in the bedroom, scruffy and unshaven, and laid flat out on the bed like a despot king, Ernest will read his book and care nothing for her. Not at first.
The Red Garden by Alice Hoffman evokes comparisons to Thornton Wilder's classic Our Town. The book meanders through time, allowing the lives and deaths of the inhabitants of Blackwell, Massachusetts, to tell the story of time's passage, of loves requited, of the inexplicable in life, and of the stamina of good plain folk. It is a glimpse of small-town America, presenting us with some 300 years of passion, dark secrets, loyalty, and redemption in a wonderful web of tales. From the town's founder, a brave young woman from England who has no fear of blizzards or bears, to the young man who runs away to New York City, the characters in the Red Garden are extraordinary and vivid. A young wounded Civil War soldier who is saved by a neighbor, a poet who falls in love with a blind man, a mysterious traveler who comes to town in a year when summer never arrives. At the center of everyone's life is a garden where only red plants can grow, and where the truth can be found by those who dare to look. The Red Garden is as unforgettable as it is moving. Let's listen as Nancy Travis narrates.
Hallie had the impression that the marriage was a mistake on their wedding night, spent at a raucous inn near Boston Harbor. William had done his husbandly business, then had dropped into a deep, twitchy sleep. He hadn't uttered a single word during their lovemaking. Soon, Hallie would realize she should have been grateful for that. But on that night, she seemed absurdly alone, considering she was a newly married woman. William had a single virtue. He was an excellent salesman. He had sold Hallie on the notion of their marriage, and soon afterward he managed to convince three other families to travel with them out west. There was safety in numbers, especially when heading across the mountains. The Motts and the Stars signed on, along with the Partridges, who had a young son named Harry. Hallie quickly began to suspect she had married a confidence man. In fact, William Brady was running from debtor's prison and a long list of failed projects that included bilking people of their earnings. He convinced the three other families to pay for everything they'd need to set out. The horses, the mules, the dried meat, the flour, the cornmeal. In exchange, William would lead the way. He said he had experience, but in fact he had never been farther west than Concord. He led them in circles for the full month of October, a foolish time to start out across uncharted land, fumbling through the wilderness until an early blinding snowstorm stopped their progress. They had just scrambled over High Top Mountain when the bad weather overtook them. Where they hunkered down in the valley below marked the beginning of Bearsville. The first person who spotted a bear was 6-year-old Harry Partridge. Winter had still not fully arrived, yet there was already snow on the ground. They'd been living like gypsies as the men tried their best to build a real shelter. Harry shouted for them to leave their work on the rickety log house and had them run down to the meadow to see. The men laughed when they spied a leafy squirrel's nest up in the tree, which might have easily looked like a vicious beast to a boy from Boston. From then on, that spot was known as Harry's Bear. "Go right past Harry's Bear and you'll find the stack of wood," they would say to each other after that. "Make a left at Harry's Bear and head for the creek." Such unconscionable teasing always made Harry's face flush. But he was not the only one who feared bears. The women, Rachel Mott, Elizabeth Starr, and Susanna Partridge, Harry's mother, were nervous when darkness fell. Food had been stolen from the wooden storehouse. They'd heard things rustling in the woods when they went to collect chokeberries, the last of the seasons, barely enough to keep them alive. They saw footprints that were monstrously large in the muck near the river. No wonder they had trouble sleeping at night. Even after they moved into the poorly built shelter where they could never stay warm, an ashy fire was kept burning day and night, airing through a hole in the roof. Smoke turned their faces and feet black, and several times they almost froze to death. They woke in the mornings with crusts of ice in their hair and on their clothes. They might have starved as well, despairing over everything that had happened in their lives since they'd had the misfortune to meet William Brady, if Hallie hadn't made her way down to the river one day, driven by hunger and fury. She could not believe how helpless her stranded group was. None of the men were skilled hunters. They knew little about survival. She felt they had all been bewitched by the mountain, ready to lie down on their straw pallets, close their eyes, and give up the one life on earth they'd been granted. Hallie went out on her own. She tramped over the frozen marshes, ignoring the patches of briars. When she got to the riverside, she took a rock and smashed through the skim of ice over the water. Then, with her bare hands, she reached into the blackness and collected a pot full of eels for a stew. They wriggled and fought the way eels do, but because of the cold, they were in a half-sleep, and Hallie easily won the fight. She'd come all the way from England, and she didn't intend to die her first winter out, not on the western side of this high, dark mountain. After that, she built traps out of twigs and rope, and with Harry beside her, began to catch rabbits in the meadow. It was November by then, and above the mountain the sky turned a luminous blue late in the day, like ink spilling out on a page. Hallie and Harry could see their breath puffing into the air as they traipsed through the woods. They could hear the rabbits scrambling underneath the traps when they were caught.
Vonnegut made his mark as one of America's most influential writers, with novels that included Slaughterhouse-Five and Cat's Cradle. He has been named one of the 100 best English language novelists by Time magazine. Published posthumously, While Mortal Sleep is a collection of 16 short stories written early in Vonnegut's career, and these further cement his status as an American literary icon. The book is wonderfully narrated by Norman Dietz.
George Castro used to come back to the homeworks of the General Household Appliances Company just once a year to install his equipment in the shell of the new model GHA refrigerator. And every time he got there, he dropped a suggestion in the suggestion box. It was always the same suggestion. Why not make next year's refrigerator in the shape of a woman? Then there would be a sketch of a refrigerator shaped like a woman, with arrows showing where the vegetable crisper and the butter conditioner and the ice cubes and all would go. George called it the Food-O-Mama. Everybody thought the Food-O-Mama was an extra good joke, because George was out on the road all year long dancing and talking and singing with a refrigerator shaped like a refrigerator. Its name was Jenny. George had designed and built Jenny back when he'd been a real comer in the GHA research laboratory. George might as well have been married to Jenny. He lived with her in the back of a moving van that was mostly filled with her electronic brains. He had a cot and a hot plate and a three-legged stool and a table and a locker in the back of the van. And he had a doormat he put on the bare ground outside when he parked the van somewhere for the night. Jenny and George, it said. It glowed in the dark. Jenny and George went from appliance dealer to appliance dealer all over the United States and Canada. They'd dance and sing and crack jokes until they'd collected a good crowd in a store. Then they'd make a strong sales pitch for all the GHA appliances standing around doing nothing. Jenny and George had been at it since 1934. George was 64 years old when I got out of college and joined the company. When I heard about George's big paycheck and his free way of life and the way he made people laugh and buy appliances, why, I guessed he was the happiest man in the company. But I never got to see Jenny and George until I got transferred out to the Indianapolis offices. One morning out there, we got a telegram saying Jenny and George were in our neck of the woods somewhere, and would we please find them and tell George his ex-wife was very sick. She wasn't expected to live. She wanted to see him. I was very surprised to hear he'd had a wife. But some of the older people in the office knew about her. George had only lived with her for 6 months, and then he'd hit the road with Jenny. His ex-wife's name was Nancy. Nancy had turned right around and married his best friend. I got the job of tracking Jenny and George down. The company never knew exactly where they were. George made his own schedule. The company gave him his head. They just kept rough track of him by his expense accounts and by rave letters they'd get from distributors and dealers. And almost every rave letter told about some new stunt that Jenny'd done that Jenny'd never been able to do before. George couldn't leave her alone. He tinkered with her every spare minute, as though his life depended on making Jenny as human as possible. I called our distributor for Central Indiana, Hal Flourish. I asked him if he knew where Jenny and George were. He laughed to beat the band and said he sure did. Jenny and George were right in Indianapolis, he said. They were out at the Hoosier Appliance Mart. He told me Jenny and George had stopped early morning traffic by taking a walk down North Meridian Street. She had on a new hat and a corsage and a yellow dress, he said. And George was all dolled up in his soup and fish and yellow spats and a cane. You would have died. And you know how he's got her fixed up now, so's he knows when her battery's running down? No, sir, I said. She yawns, he said, and her eyelids get all droopy.
Readers, thank you so much for joining me today on our cultural crisscrossing of our country. Please journey through our complete archives of shows on our website, www.bookreportradio.com. And for those of my readers who are currently in a book group, drop me a line at elaine@bookreportradio.com. An upcoming book report will feature favorites from book groups around the country, and I'd love for you to be one of my guests. Again, that's Elaine at bookreportradio.com. This is Elaine Charles, and I look forward to being with you in a week for the next chapter of The Book Report.